The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the July and August 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll begin with an article titled The Spy and the Forest by Sean Assale. An 18th century French botanist supported by Thomas Jefferson faced a historic decision. He chose betrayal. In December 1792, a 46-year-old French botanist named André Michaud arrived in Philadelphia to visit with some of the city's most influential citizens. Michaud had spent much of his adult life sloshing across muddy rivers and hacking through mosquito-infested forests, but he could clean up and turn on the charm when it suited his purposes, as it did when he paid a call on Benjamin Rush, the physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, and Rush's colleague Benjamin Barton, a well-known naturalist. Both men belonged to the American Philosophical Society, the nation's foremost scientific organization, which had been founded 50 years earlier to promote useful knowledge. Michaud, the educated son of a farmer, told Barton that it would be useful for the United States to have geographical knowledge of the country west of the Mississippi. His words were dry, but the idea was explosive. He wanted to transform the American continent, and with it his own reputation, by becoming the first explorer to forge a path to the Pacific. Barton relayed Michaud's idea to the Society's vice president, Thomas Jefferson, who also happened to be the U.S. Secretary of State. Jefferson's obsession with the frontier west of the Mississippi River was well known. His library at Monticello had more books about it than anywhere else on earth, filling his head with visions of woolly mammoths and purple volcanoes. More important, he viewed uniting the ends of the continent as destiny, a prerequisite for creating an American empire of liberty. But there was a difficulty. In 1792, America was bordered to the west by the Mississippi River and to the south by Florida. Much of the rest of what would become the United States, including Louisiana, was controlled by Spain. And while Spain was a relatively docile neighbor, Jefferson feared that sending American explorers onto its soil might provoke a war. A French naturalist, on the other hand, was a perfect solution. Jefferson had good reason to trust Michaud. France's King Louis XVI had personally appointed Michaud to be his royal botanist, with a blank check to travel the world. He had survived being robbed by Bedouins in the Middle East and nearly froze with his native guides during an expedition in the Canadian wilderness. Upon moving to the United States and purchasing a large plantation in South Carolina, where he collected specimens before shipping them to France, he also became something of an expert on American Indians. His knack for getting into places unreachable by others led him to make hundreds of discoveries, a catalog of New World plant and animal life that would fill libraries. On receiving Barton's message, Jefferson wrote back to ask how soon Michaud could start. "In consequence of your note," Barton replied on January 4, 1793, "I have waited on Mr. Michaud and learned he will engage in his scheme as soon as you think proper." Jefferson acted quickly to secure the support of President George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and Henry Knox, as well as 14 U.S. senators and 14 U.S. representatives, among them James Madison. Jefferson also personally drew up a contract that called on Michaud to take notice of the country you pass through, its general face, soil, rivers, mountains, its productions, animal, vegetable, and mineral, so far as they may be new to us and may also be useful or very curious. Michaud, despite of, or because of, his humble beginnings, cared deeply about his reputation, and he was eager to be accepted as an accomplished man of science. On April 30, 1793, he wrote Jefferson promising to devote myself to this without reserve. But even though Michaud was an unparalleled chronicler of nature in the young America, he never found broad recognition, in part because he didn't lecture widely, unlike the American botanist William Bartram, his lifelong friend, or teach at prominent universities. Also, he published his scientific work in French and sent his collections to Europe. Today, we aren't even sure what he looked like. No portrait survives. From the appearance of his son, François, a distinguished botanist in his own right, we can guess that the Michaud pair had curly black hair, a severe nose, and a dimpled chin, but that's only a guess. Likewise, we have little insight into his personal feelings and opinions. His writing, like his ambition, was technical, not reflective. Now, a retired public librarian named Charlie Williams is trying to restore Michaud to the pantheon of great naturalists. In recent years, the 75-year-old Williams, who lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, founded an André Michaud International Society, convened academic symposiums to encourage scholarship about his life and work, and even wrote a one-act play about the explorer, which he's been known to perform in period dress. Last year, he and two biologist colleagues, Elaine Norman and Walter Kingsley Taylor, reached a milestone when they published André Michaud in North America, the first English translation of 9 volumes of journals and letters that Michaud wrote during his American sojourn between 1785 and 1796. The immense 608-page volume, 2 decades in the making, resurrects Michaud's epic wanderlust. He was the greatest explorer of his age, Williams says, but history just kind of forgot him. Why? The reason has to do with a mix of 18th-century patriotism and revolutionary fervor and political naivete. Michaud did embark on a spy mission in 1793, but it wasn't the one he devised with Jefferson. And 230 years later, historians are still debating the role that Jefferson played in bringing it all to a disastrous head. André Michaud was born on a 400-acre farm south of Versailles, where his father managed land belonging to the king. His childhood and the gardens around the palace were relatively privileged, and he learned the family's trade and the expectation that he'd continue in it. But a succession of tragedies altered that plan. His father died when he was 17, and his mother 3 years later. 4 years after that, his wife lost her life shortly after giving birth to their son, François. A royal physician who knew the family thought Michaud needed a fresh start and introduced him to botany. Michaud instantly took to the subject and worked his way up, including a stint as an apprentice on an expedition to the mountains Auvergne in France, with Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, the giant of 18th-century naturalism. In 1782, he joined a royal expedition to the Middle East that involved around 120 men and 180 camels. In examining the multitude of plants with which the fields abound, he wrote on a stopover in Aleppo, "I was transported beyond myself and compelled to pause and tranquilize my mind for some moments." He stargazed for his bearings and marveled that people he met in Baghdad cooked in wood stoves using tamarisk, an evergreen shrub he had never seen before. On his own, he faced multitudes of dangers. He was attacked by Bedouins, held for ransom, and forced to pay bribes. When he reached the port city of Bushehr in what is today Iran, he was robbed of what little he had left. The English consul in that city was so astonished by his ordeal that he gave Michaud provisions to continue to the Indian Ocean, even though England was then at war with France. By the time Michaud returned to Paris in 1785, his travels had become legendary. Louis XVI, eager to seed his sublime Chateau de Rambouillet with the flora of the New World, approached Michaud to serve as the royal botanist and told him to sail to America with dispatch. "I have nothing to fear so much as leaving discoveries to be made by those who shall come with me," Michaud wrote as he set off with 15-year-old Francois. Those were busy times. After a brief stay near Hoboken, New Jersey, father and son settled in Charleston, South Carolina, where the weather was optimal for harvesting plants and seeds. The native trees, and those naturalized from Asia, seemed assured to fare well in France, and there were easy access to the port to send shipments home. Michaud bought a 111-acre plantation, and exploiting the labor of 24 enslaved workers, turned the place into his laboratory. No sooner would he drop off the fruits of one adventure than he was off on another. After a jaunt through Georgia, he talked his way into Spanish Florida, marveling at how oranges grew with scarcely any care, and how the shoreline, covered in the yellow Elysium, smelled of anise. On a trip down the Little Tennessee River, he stumbled on a mile wide field covered by strawberry bushes, whose roots he gathered for rambouillet. He followed the Kiowa River into the Blue Ridge Mountains and found an Indian camp where the head of the village received us courteously, and the man's daughter served boiled deer meat and cornbread. After reaching Tuskegee Ford, 14 miles from Charlotte, he recounted passing the Lincoln and Burke courthouses, beyond which lay a new astragalus and a menispermum with black fruits. Michaud's idyllic travels stood in stark contrast to the bloody revolutionary violence sweeping through France. Riots broke out across the country, creating enough instability that the king fled Paris with his family, only to be captured and taken back to live under house arrest. As the son of a farmer, who had never owned his own land, Michaud was not unsympathetic to the aims of the revolution. As a younger man in France, in fact, he contributed funds towards a shipment of arms for the American Revolution, and his social circles in Philadelphia and Charleston comprised expatriate Frenchmen who were outspoken advocates for the new French Republic. At the same time, the cost of maintaining the Charleston plantation was considerable, and he was running out of money. Things were so dire that he was refused credit by a banker in New York. In Paris, the king's courtiers, including the aide overseeing Michaud's mission, were fleeing the city. Michaud was now more isolated than ever, as Henry and Elizabeth Savage explain in André and François André Michaud, their 1986 joint biography of father and son. Then, in January 1793, the revolution's executioners beheaded the king and made Michaud a man without a job or a country. That spring, Europe was a tinderbox. The king's execution united other monarchs against the French Republic, which was struggling with infighting and sliding towards civil war. France had declared war on Austria in the misguided hope that the population would revolt. After instituting a draft, the French expanded the conflict to Britain, which supported counter-revolutionary forces in the French provinces, and to Spain, which sent an army over the Pyrenees. By March, Portugal, the Kingdom of Naples, and the Holy Roman Empire had joined the fray, creating what became known as the First Coalition against France. In the United States, President Washington's advisors were split over whether to take sides. Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton supported Britain, arguing that monarchy was a stabilizing force. Jefferson, on the other hand, wanted to pay for time. France had supported America's revolution, he reminded everyone, and deserved the benefit of the doubt. All this instability created opportunities for anyone canny enough to cash in on it, and that included a former American Revolutionary War general who was living in Kentucky named George Rogers Clark. After a series of self-financed military endeavors left him deep in debt, Clark wrote to the French Foreign Ministry with a proposal to help further its ambitions. He would raise a private army of Native Americans and settlers to drive Spain out of the territories it controlled west of the Mississippi, thereby opening the Mississippi River and the port of New Orleans to French and American commerce and the lands beyond to American settlement. Remarkably, the idea found an audience in Paris. French officials had already concluded that Spain was overleveraged in Louisiana and therefore vulnerable. In fact, a young envoy named Edmond Charles Genet was crossing the Atlantic with orders to inflame the situation as much as possible. The suave, red-haired Genet arrived in Philadelphia in May 1793 to a rapturous reception. David Rittenhouse, president of the American Philosophical Society, director of the United States Mint, and a close ally of Jefferson's, led a procession of citizens to the City Hotel to welcome our first and best ally. Michaud, who was one of the best-connected Frenchmen in America and was hoping to get funding from the French government, was among those who lined up to meet him. Genet found him estimable in all respects, enjoying here a great regard. He wrote in a letter to France's Minister of Foreign Affairs. Even better, Genet thought the botanist would be a perfect addition to Clark's secret mission to raise an army against Spain, since he was accustomed to travel in the hinterlands of America, and his departure can be suspicious to no one. This was treacherous ground, not least because President Washington had resolved the split in his cabinet by announcing that the United States would stay neutral in the European conflict. Nonetheless, when Genet told Michaud that the French Republic required his services as a liaison to the American general, Michaud made a decision that would echo through the centuries. He crossed Washington and went to work as a spy for his country instead. Historians debate why Michaud, a driven naturalist, would forgo the promising scientific mission on behalf of the American Philosophical Society for one that carried so much risk. The answers range from prosaic. He may have seen the Genet mission as a brief interlude, never thinking it would prevent him from reaching the Pacific, to the romantic. He'd been swept up in the spirit of the French Revolution. In his notes to André Michaud in North America, Williams points out that Michaud had been arguing with Jefferson over who would get credit for the discoveries Michaud would make during his expedition, a key concern for a man determined to win the respect of France's scientific elite. The Kentucky mission may have seemed an attractive alternative. Genet now gave him the opportunity to be the first botanist to visit the area, while promising him both an annual government stipend and an even larger amount for expenses, Williams writes. In Undaunted Courage, the 1996 bestseller about the Lewis and Clark expedition, the author Stephen Ambrose added his own twist to the debate by casting Michaud a little more than a scheming spy. Michaud had scarcely reached Kentucky when Jefferson discovered he was a secret agent of the French Republic, Ambrose wrote. Ambrose's reputation as a popular historian lent great legitimacy to that view, but Williams' good-natured calm melts when I ask him about it. Ambrose just missed the boat, he says. He got it wrong. In Williams's view, it wasn't Michaud who was duplicitous and scheming, but Jefferson himself. Williams's interpretation is based on his study of fast-moving events that began in early July 1793. When Genet challenged Washington's neutrality by converting a merchant ship into an armed privateer that would launch attacks from American ports. With tensions high, Jefferson met with Genet in Philadelphia to try to calm the waters. The man sat face to face, and Jefferson listened as Genet laid out his plans, including his instructions to Michaud to help raise a mercenary army. Jefferson grasped the implications immediately. As he later wrote in a memo, I told Genet that enticing officers and soldiers to go against Spain was really putting a halter about their necks, for that they would be assuredly be hung if they commenced hostilities against a nation at peace with the United States. It's what Jefferson did next, though, that suggests a dual agenda. In a letter to James Madison dated July 7th, Jefferson called Genet's appointment as envoy calamitous and complained he'd been disrespectful and even indecent toward President Washington. Privately, however, Jefferson agreed to assist Genet. He wrote a letter to the American governor of Kentucky to ensure that Michaud, whom he called a man of science and merit, would have no trouble arranging a meeting with General Clark. Why would Jefferson publicly defend Washington and discredit Genet only to help the French envoy behind the scenes? That Jefferson could be a calculating, wily politician is hardly a novel idea, and some scholars have suggested that he was conducting what amounted to shadow foreign policy by trying to dislodge Spain from its American territories because he believed the United States would have more influence over a French neighbor. If true, his maneuvering proved prophetic after Napoleon acquired Louisiana from Spain in 1800 in setting up the Louisiana Purchase. But nobody has gone as far as Williams in accusing Jefferson of using Michaud as a pawn for his own political ends. Alan Taylor, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia, supports the idea that Jefferson was likely working several angles at once. It was an age when science, geopolitics, and espionage entwined, as they probably still do, Taylor told me in an email. Given Jefferson's talent for intrigue and deception, I would not be surprised if he knew more about Michaud's filibustering expedition than he let on. On July 16, 1793, Michaud left Philadelphia with two French guards. It took them 6 weeks of slow going to reach Kentucky. He visited people he'd been directed to meet by French consul, and he made numerous side excursions to maintain his cover as a botanist. Whatever he wasn't in a hurry. In the meantime, Genet was rapidly wearing out his welcome with the American government. At a reception at Washington's home in Philadelphia, Genet badgered his way into a private audience with the president, which he used to insist that France would prevail in Europe and sue for peace on terms that France herself would dictate and that she would not forget the United States. Washington, who heard this as a threat, responded icily by saying that he considered what the French had said about him to be of very slight importance. Even Jefferson soon had enough of the quarrelsome envoy. When Washington convened a cabinet meeting to decide whether to revoke Genet's credentials, Jefferson wrote that only a determined system of moderation kept him from siding with hardliners such as Hamilton, who wanted Genet expelled right away. For his part, Hamilton published an essay in Philadelphia's newspapers, revealing that Genet had threatened to bypass diplomatic channels and use the media to rally the American public against Washington's neutrality. By the time Michaud presented Jefferson's recommendation letter to Kentucky's governor, the pro-French feeling that had been widespread in the United States was evaporating. Meanwhile, stories against the secret French plot to raise an army against Spain were spreading. Two Spanish officials wrote Jefferson to let him know that they learned that France was planning an expedition projected against Louisiana, and Spain started reinforcing its gunboats along the Mississippi. Yet, when Michaud finally reached Clark on September 17, 1793, he was stunned to discover that the general had no idea how far his idea had gone. Michaud wrote in his journal, "I gave him the letters of the minister, Genet, and told him the object of my mission. He answered about the enterprise in question was dear to his heart, but since he had written so long ago about it without any answer, he thought the project had been abandoned." One might think Michaud's diaries would be filled with anger at having put so much misplaced faith in Clark, but the new translation shows that one would be wrong, to wit. Sunday, September 22nd. I arrived in Danville at 5 o'clock in the evening. I wrote to Minister Genet on that day and sent it by Philadelphia Post. September 23rd, I rested. It wasn't until October that Clark finally agreed to start raising the army for France, and by then it was too late. Winter was dawning, which meant any surprise attack would have to wait until spring. More importantly, the political ground had shifted. President Washington directed Jefferson to send the French government a bill of particulars against Genet. The French, eager to resolve the crisis, responded by dispatching a replacement, and Genet's operations were all canceled. The Spanish governor of Louisiana, now aware of the details, swore out an arrest warrant for Michaud in case he tried to slip into Spanish territory again. His cover blown, his arrangement with the American Philosophical Society in tatters, and once again without a benefactor, Michaud returned to South Carolina. Never content to rest for long, Michaud embarked on an expedition through the Blue Ridges, where he filled his notebooks with observations that have been a kind of your text for Appalachian environmentalists. In August 1794, he became the first explorer to reach the summit of North Carolina's Grandfather Mountain, one of the highest peaks of the range's eastern edge. At the top, he launched into La Marseillaise, the new French national anthem, and shouted, "Long life to America and the French Republic, long life to liberty." Today you can get t-shirts and 50-cent shot glasses at the gift shop at the summit, but you can't find a single mention of Michaud. Yet his work lives in the plants named after him, Michaud's sumac, the fern Pleopeltis michaudania, wildflower named Michaud's saxifrage. There are also the plants he described, such as the tulip tree with a 24-foot circumference and speckled wood lilies with softly hairy flowers in umbels that he found near the base of Black Mountain. In 1795, Michaud used the last of his personal savings to finance a year-long expedition to the American interior that took him to Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois, where he learned that France and Spain had reached a truce. Elated, he tried to find guides to help him resume his delayed journey to the Pacific, but by then he was broke. In August 1796, he sailed back to Paris to be reunited with Francois, who returned a few years earlier to raise money. The rest of his life, alas, was riddled by disappointment. Michaud was devastated to learn that most of the 60,000 plants and 90 cases of seeds that he'd sent home over the years had been crushed by the Revolution, in many cases literally, as specimens had been planted at royal estates and private gardens that didn't survive the chaos. Michaud spent the next few years in his home at Paris, isolated as he worked on his illustrated opus, The Oaks of North America. It wasn't until 1800, at the age of 54, that he was given a chance to go back into the field as a senior botanist on a research vessel called the Naturaliste, Napoleon, to sail to Australia. During a stopover in the island of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, Michaud glimpsed contentment, Deleuze wrote. He passed his days sleeping under trees in the forest and enjoying the hospitality of a wealthy colonist. With the itch to explore struck again 6 months later, in June 1802, Michaud sailed 500 miles to Madagascar, whose isolation promised plant life not seen anywhere else in the world. He arrived in late summer, and working long days, he cleared bush and turned over dirt to establish a new garden that he planted to use as a hub to ferry his discoveries to Mauritius and then to Paris, where Francois continued to promote his work. The boxes and specimens never made their journey to France. In October 1802, the 11th year of the French Republic, Michaud contracted a fever and died. I asked Williams if he thought Michaud ever got over the way his life was altered by what became known as the Genet Affair. "I don't think he ever regretted being a patriot," Williams said, "but his dream was to always feel the Pacific lap in his feet. He had wanted it so much, in fact, that in 1800 he obtained Dutch passports so he could sail to the Pacific via the Dutch East Indies, hoping to find a route to St. Louis." Performing his one-man play about Michaud, Williams emphasizes the man qualities, not his failure. He asked audience members to close their eyes and imagine Michaud as bold when boldness was required, careful when necessary, and no fool. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.